It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
Well, I'm talking to someone I've had a guest before. I feel like you're an old friend, Catherine, because you were one of the early guests on when I started doing podcasts. And you're back. And now we can find out what's been happening for the last couple of years. Catherine Parker. And Catherine, you have a combination of things in your title. And you are a missionary with the Methodist Church, but you also are the Health and Community Transformation Advisor in Nepal.
That's right. With an organization called the United Mission to Nepal.
And the United Missions are a lot of churches, right?
Yeah, we have 35 global partners involved in the United Mission to Nepal.
Now, that's unusual in itself. I think
it is.
That some people, and in fact, I've heard some controversies about missions before, because they felt that a missionary would come in and say, my church is best, and if you want to go to heaven, you better go to my church.
Well,
and
the church,
there was a feeling that they had that competition.
There has been in other places. In Nepal, the Christian community was really founded and organized by Nepalis who had lived outside the country and came home again. And as the United Mission to Nepal, we are there to work in partnership, not to start churches, not to take leadership in those churches, but really to be working in parallel and in partnership with our community there as we pursue peace and justice and address the root causes of poverty.
You know, we're going to back into all of these issues, the reason that you have common interests that people are involved with, but I want to come back and start with, what does this have to do with farm to table, in a sense? And I'm wondering, the reference of farm to table or farm to fork in the United States is something that's become more popular in the last, maybe 5 years or so. And yet it's a really, really old concept. Would farm to fork or farm to table mean anything in Nepal?
Well, very much so, because Nepal, about 65% of the Nepali population are involved in subsistence level agriculture. So growing food just for their own family. Really very basic levels of farm to fork. There in your own small gardens, in your small plots, growing rice in the lowlands, or as you move up in elevation, wheat and corn and millet and potatoes, depending on where you are in the mountains of Nepal.
Do they eat many meat animals? There's some of the areas I think about it being vegetarian, and I'm not sure if there's a lot of vegetarian in Nepal.
There are a large number of vegetarians in Nepal. Cows, of course, in the Hindu tradition, which is the dominant religion of Nepal, are sacred, and so cows are not killed for food products. But goat is very popular. The goat is the most expensive meat in Nepal, and of course, chicken. Everybody loves chicken, so those are certainly consumed in Nepal, although certainly at lower quantities than we often find here in the United States.
Now, if you asked anybody to identify a city in Nepal, some of them would remember hearing Kathmandu,
because
it was a Bob Seger song of back in my era that, you know, Kathmandu. And it also seemed to be a place that backpackers would go to. And back when we used to have hippies always thought they had to go to Nepal, but they go to Kathmandu. I would imagine Kathmandu is a very, very large city.
But
is Nepal got a lot of small cities?
Nepal is a very diverse country. It's got almost 30 million people, most of whom live in the lowlands, in the big cities down in the lowlands. Certainly lots of people in Kathmandu. But then in all of these mountain villages, in very dispersed parts throughout the hills, is the rest of the population.
So if you go to a village, let's say your village, would you describe it as a village or a city where you live now?
Well, it feels a lot like a village because people live very densely, so we don't have a lot of houses, but there are 30,000 people in Musikot, the district headquarters of Rukum District in western Nepal, where I spend the majority of my time. And then from there, we take the dirt roads up over the 11,000-foot passes and walk until we reach some of the true villages, which maybe only have 1,000 people living in them.
And those passes, they look, I've seen pictures, they look dangerous. And I've heard you before say you wait to see whether or not the mules are going to go, because if they don't take the pack, mules don't want to go, you don't want to go.
Well, I'm slow and I'm cautious. So that is my rule. I want to go on where the trail's not too steep.
Well, but those mules are on little tiny trails going along the edge of the mountains. And some of the villages you go, you actually do back, you know, have mules that are packing in supplies.
Yeah, many of the communities where we work do use mule trains to bring in their supplies, like salt and oil, things that you can't grow in your own village. And so when I go in, I travel pretty light because, of course, we are always welcomed by a host in the village who provides accommodation and feeds us while we're there. So I only carry about a 20-liter backpack with maybe one change of clothes and my toothbrush, and you can make that work for about a week.
Oh, well, and when you get there, can you pretty much predict what you're going to have to eat when you get to the villages?
Yeah, so Nepal is an interesting country because it's in between India and China, and so there is culinary influence from both sides, but your main meal that you eat at 9 a.m. and at 7 p.m. is called dal bhat. It's similar to an Indian thali, so dal, lentils, bhat, rice, little curried vegetable, mostly cauliflower and potatoes, but sometimes some green beans and such. Lots of fresh green vegetables in terms of things like saag. Saag is mustard greens that we love to eat. So I love those cooked mustard greens, but nettles, we eat those as well, cooked.
Now, is it, do you use a hot sauce or any kind of spices with them too?
Oh, certainly. So a char is what we call it. It's like a chutney. It's often a tomato-based hot sauce or spicy salsa type a sauce.
Now, it gets cold there too. You have some pretty serious winters there, don't you?
Well, yes. The snow doesn't really stick until 9,000-10,000 feet, but it certainly gets down to freezing weathers in the winter season. But the rains come in the summer, so the winters are cold and dry.
How do they keep the food? I mean, if they are getting fresh vegetables now, how are they able to have food available through the winter?
Well, we do get sun, but the challenge in the winter is actually having sufficient water to grow vegetables. Mm. And so that is one of the things when we've been working with communities on vegetable gardening, on kitchen gardening there next to their house, we have been promoting having a nice little washing station. So that may be either a nice stone slate, or maybe we'll bring in some cement and build a little washing station that channels the gray water into the kitchen garden area so that there still is some water in those dry season to grow, you know, a little bit of your hearty mustard greens or other winter crops, spinach-like greens that grow.
Do they can too?
No, there's no canning. Canning takes a lot of fuel, and mostly Nepalis are cooking over open flame in these remote villages, and so that is not a very efficient way to cook. We have been trying to introduce metal stoves, which are more efficient at cooking, but again, those are hard to transport in and expensive. So as they come in, that does reduce people's fuel consumption, but not enough to really do canning. So pickling.
What about chickens? They eat eggs?
Mostly in the lower elevations. Again, when you get up a little higher, sometimes it's too cold for chickens, so you have to build special houses for them. But yes, people love chickens. They love eggs.
Now, in these, where they're trying to subsist and grow food for themselves. Mm-hmm. So how would you describe it? Do they don't own a farm?
They do
own a farm. So they have a house and a barn or something?
Not so much a barn. I think 25 R is about the average land holding. I don't know how to convert that into acres, but less than an acre is the average family farm holding. So that's enough to grow a single crop that may or may not meet your full year's requirement for your grains, right? Your corn or your rice or your millet, whatever you're growing up there. And then vegetable gardens are grown just in small plots next to the family house area. Beyond that, people do a lot of herding in the highlands. So herding of goats, herding sheep, cattle, yaks as well, for their milk.
So did the milk, and did they make cheese out of it?
Some cheese, more a dahi, which is a thin yogurt. That's the preservation mode that's preferred for the milk products, as well as ghee, which is a clarified butter, because those all require, you can keep them for a couple days without refrigeration.
So when you picture a typical family that's producing some of their own food, and they have around an acre, and are they working off the farm, too, or are they just working the farm?
That is correct, that they are working off the farm, and that's partly what we mean by subsistence-level agriculture. They're not farming for selling, although we do some work around helping people to form cooperatives so that they can sell their vegetables together. Because one farmer can't grow enough cauliflower, for example, to load up, have a full basket to take down to the city, to the market center, the city where I live. But if farmers work together, if they can get a little collection center, then, you know, 30, 40, 50 houses can all bring some vegetables in, and then one person can carry it 3-4 hours down the hill to sell.
Now, you do some of that, don't you, as far as encouraging them in forming cooperatives. Do you go into an area and say, this is something you ought to look at. Let's all get together, bring a bunch of people in, you know, and, you know, we'll put another goat on the fire or something and
yes,
have a potluck.
So it's always when we come into a community, there's a long dialogue process as we enter and as we look towards what is the passion, what are the skills, what are the resources already existing in this community, and how can we work to enhance those? We have a curriculum we call Start and Grow Your Own Small Business.
Oh, that's good.
Which is an important starting place as we talk together and we look at what are some of the ways in which we can capitalize on what is happening right here and expand on that. In an area out in Bajang in far western Nepal, we identified a community that traditionally had raised cattle, milk them, have lots of milk, have an excess of milk, but they hadn't been selling the milk. And so we talked with them about why they hadn't been selling it. And some of it was lack of knowledge about how to organize and how to market their product. And so we worked with them on that. But there were also superstitious beliefs that were holding people back. Beliefs that if I, being a person of a high caste, sell milk to a person of a Dalit or a so-called low caste, mm-hmm, untouchable family, that might invite an evil spirit or my cow might die. And so that took a lot of community dialogue as well to kind of overcome some of that. We were interviewing one of the women who participates in this, and she was saying, well, we've been selling milk for a year now, and nothing bad has happened. So
yeah, maybe they'll decide I can go another cast and
that's right,
sell to them then.
Yeah, so overcoming some of these challenges as well is part of that dialogue process that we help to facilitate.
Now, when you're describing the food that they're growing, then I'm thinking about your background and affiliation as a Methodist missionary. Then I think you had to go over and teach them how to do potluck.
Methodists, we love to have potluck. And in Kathmandu, we have been, among my team members, starting to have potlucks during our every quarterly technical forum meeting. We like to do that together. But Nepalis do love to come together, love to eat together in fellowship. The Nepali meal always has all of these wonderful dishes. I'm so impressed with Nepali women who make 5-6 different dishes for every meal. It's amazing to me. I'm not that good of a cook
myself.
And so
there is that much variety, so that when you do have them all bring the food together and let's all get together, because I think it's an important condition. You were talking about trying to form cooperatives to deal with some of their agriculture issues, but almost farmers and households everywhere need food to be able to,
right,
to get them to come in the first place.
Yeah.
And let's all eat together, and then you can have a conversation.
Yes,
Is that usually the way it goes? Like if you get a building and they're all bringing this food for whatever a Nepali potluck is, and then you get up with a projector and show a PowerPoint or something?
Oh, well, there's not electricity of that type up in the villages that we work in. I'd say maybe 10-15% of the houses in these areas have a little 12-inch by 12-inch solar panel, which is enough to power a light in the evening. You could charge a cell phone off of that. And some of the villages are finally getting cell towers out there, so connections are coming. But these are remote areas.
Now, the kids that are growing up in those areas, and you're trying to help them in the schools too, there's a food connection in the schools, is there not?
That's right. Up in the Atbiskot municipality in the northern part of Rukum District, we've been working with the schools there. And like many schools in Nepal, up to grade 8, the World Food Program provides rice and lentils and oil so that the kids can have a midday snack, we call it khichdi, of that mixed lentil rice porridge. Well, one of our schools, Shala, we work with the kids there. We promote peer education, having children teach other children. And they put together a lesson every week for an hour and teach about hygiene and about nutrition and about things like kitchen gardening, growing vegetables. Well, some of the kids in our Shala school, they asked their head teacher if they could grow vegetables at school. And their head teacher said, yes. And he even bought them seeds, which I was so encouraged by the way that he was supportive of these children. Well, now that the children are growing those vegetables, they're being added to the midday snack for the children. And just last week, I got a notice from one of my coworkers that the children have been highlighted in one of the national newspapers for their initiative in doing this. So I am so proud of these kids. This village is not easy to get to. To get out to Rukum, you start in Kathmandu, it's an hour and 15-minute flight on a twin otter plane, little tiny plane. And from there, we take the jeep about 6 hours and then walk 2 hours. Or if that road gets blocked with landslides from the monsoon or ice, from the where the road ends about 3 hours in, the mules can get in there in about 6 hours. So it's remote.
Are the seeds available to you, the seeds that they're wanting to produce? Because I'm sure you don't produce the same kind of vegetables necessarily that you do here. And yet I also hear that, like in the entire world now, there's four companies that have 60% of all the seeds in the world are controlled by four companies. And so I'm wondering about what might be available, the variety and of what they need to be able to grow.
Yeah, so Nepal is not self-sufficient in the seeds needed in the country for producing vegetables. A lot of those seeds are imported from other parts of the world. But Rukum, which is a particularly hilly area, has all of these lovely little pockets, which are ideal for farmers who want to raise vegetable seeds. And so Rukum itself as a district is the number one producer of vegetable seeds for the rest of the country. And they produce onion seeds, radish seeds, the daikon radish, cauliflower, and such like this. So those are a wonderful product coming out of Rukum. And we've been working with those farmers as well. They work down along the river basins is where most of the vegetable seeds are grown. We started working with them about 6 years ago to form cooperatives. And we formed 122 cooperatives throughout the district. And when we formed the cooperative, we could then work with the farmers to improve their techniques, particularly their processing techniques, the way that they dry the seed. Because when you dry the seed properly, you get better germination. Mm-hmm. So building small drying sheds where the cooperative members could work together on that. After 5 years of that project, we have now organize them as the Federation of Vegetable Seed Cooperatives in Rukum, and they are an independent organization that continues to work. My coworker, as part of his master's thesis, was looking at the impact of this, and he said we, over those 5 years, were able to double the tonnage of vegetable seeds being produced in the district and increase the percentage of the market share to farmers by 30%.
Wow. That's got to be big. And if their incomes are increasing and they're and nutrition is improving too. Do you see anything in the children that they're doing better in school or anything like that related to having better nutrition? Because I know in some parts of the world there's issues with stunting because there's just not, they may be getting calories, but they're not getting the right sort of calories.
Yes, and actually Nepal is first in the world in terms of stunting. I don't know if that's the best way to put it, but yes, stunting is a major issue in Nepal. And a lot of what we're looking at in terms of stunting is actually the poor sanitation conditions in Nepal is really where we're seeing the possibility to address stunting. And so we are working a lot in Nepal also on making sure that people have access to a latrine and that there is total sanitation, because even if you're consuming a sufficient quantity of calories, if you have that subclinical level of infection that comes from constant reintroduction of pathogens, that contributes to a poor absorption of the nutrients and contributes to stunting as well. One of the things, though, with the increased income and the increased availability of vegetables and other farm products that I've directly seen impacting in Nepal has more to do with the migration issue. Nepal also exports human labor. That's its number one export.
Really?
Yes. So a lot of Nepalis work in seasonal migratory labor down in India to send money home. And it young kids, 14, 15-year-olds, I see them on the trails headed down for this kind of migratory labor. And so when you can increase the income of the family there on the farm, mm-hmm. It takes a very small increase in the farm family's income to dissuade people from engaging in that seasonal migratory labor. And that is important for children on many levels as well.
Now, will they have available to them a level of training all the way through high school?
Yeah, so the Nepali education system, it follows the British system. So there is this important exam that you take at the end of 10th grade. You do have to pass that in order to continue on for your plus two. But that is available. If you pass that exam, high school education is available through the public school system.
And then how many of them are you starting to see going on to one college somewhere?
Oh, I don't have the statistics on that. We are still really working on getting kids up there through 10th grade, taking and passing that exam. So where we as United Mission to Nepal are focused is more on still on that primary level education, because only about 50% of the kids that take that exam at 10th grade pass it.
So as the world meets Nepal, I would imagine when you go to Kathmandu, you could probably don't have to go down many blocks before you run into a Starbucks, right?
Oh, there's no Starbucks there, but we just get a KFC recently.
Oh, well, then you're going. I mean, China's had KFCs and Starbucks for a long time, so Nepal's just at the early Starbucks stage. That's something to watch. Are there other Western chains that are coming, you're starting to see, or any supermarket chains?
There are some local supermarket chains, Big Mart, Bhatini, but those are very much local businesses that are developing. Nepal's coffee industry is also just emerging. They've been growing coffee just over a decade now in Nepal, but some wonderful shade-grown mountain coffee.
Free trade, I suppose.
Of course, yes.
So they're keeping track of that they're getting their share of the profits?
That's what the companies tell me when I buy from them there in Kathmandu. So let's hope that it's really happening, not just marketing.
I'm wondering, when you've been over there for a while now, how long have you been there?
6 years now in Nepal.
Okay, 6 years. And you've been back over here now for some months, going to nearly a dozen different states as you come back every 3 years and make the rounds, and you've had organizations and churches that are supporting you. You come back to tell what you're doing so that they understand it better, and they hopefully will continue to support the efforts there in Nepal. But when you're approaching the end of a trip like this, what makes you think, I'm ready to go home? And my home in this case is Nepal.
Nepal, yes. Well, the traffic here certainly gets to me. Yeah. But it is an amazing thing to be part of a connectional world. And to know that, you know, what we're doing here in this country of connecting people to food really parallels what's going on all around the world. And as we work with Nepalis also to grow their kitchen gardens, to really make sure that they're focusing on nutrition in the same way that we're focusing on nutrition here, on making sure that people are getting good, fresh vegetables and connecting with the land and the food and the farm. These are things that we need to be thinking about all around the world. And so I love that this is an important part of our culture here, an increasingly growing awareness here as we turn to that focus on, you know, food, direct connection to our food, because that is so much a part of what's going on in Nepal as well.
It is really interesting because as you were describing what you're doing over there, I was thinking that there are some large cities in the United States that there's urban farming going on and rooftop gardens and getting the schools involved and learning how to produce food. And in some cases, you know, they're hoping they might be able to continue doing it later on, too.
Yeah.
But it really does seem true now that it's all over the world. And it is exciting that there is that common thread. And even if it seems like what else they're working on is trying to deal with health issues, deal with education issues, food plays a role. It's a demonstration. It's something to keep them going, or it's something, you know, or in your case, you can be teaching them potlucks for the co-ops you're organizing.
As we come together in fellowship, and as you say, I mean, food binds us together.
You know, you have a theme that you talk about, growing together. You've been growing on this journey yourself. Tell me a little bit about why you decided to go down this path. I mean, there's a lot of other ways one can spend their lives other than going to a village in Nepal, but what took you down this path?
Well, lots of turns and lots of motivation along the way. I went to a school down in Southern California that had this vision of training scientists with a clear understanding of the impact of their work on society. And I was really interested in molecular biology and root development in plants, but I was worried that the research I was doing in basic science, I wanted to make sure that I was doing things that helped people who are in subsistence level situations, folks who are struggling with food security. And so I wanted, I shifted some of my thinking towards a more participatory research approach. And I got involved with a group in Iowa called Practical Farmers of Iowa that was very much involved in linking farmers with researchers at Iowa State University so that research can be done to benefit small and mid-scale family farms here in this country. And I said I really wanted to see how we as a global community can be supportive of each other in knowing our own locations better, so that we can make intentional choices about how we use the resources that are available to us. And I was really interested in the cycling of nutrients in the farm system, especially using microbiology in that. And that's what led me to water quality and looking at microbial testing of water, but doing that in a participatory way. So I don't think I had any idea that I would end up in Nepal.
Well, you were in another country before you were in Nepal, were you not?
That's correct. I served also in Cambodia, over 5 years in Cambodia, in that place as well. And in the United Methodist Church, we send missionaries where they have been invited. Mm-hmm. And so both of the receiving organizations, the one in Cambodia, the one in Nepal, also where I served in Japan, as well as Practical Farmers of Iowa, the organization who received me, they said, these are the skills we need. Would you provide somebody with those skills to support us? And I was invited by the church then to respond to those requests. And so that's how I ended up in Nepal.
What's interesting to me is that something you touched on a little earlier is that you drop in an area and do good. I mean, you start sizing up issues, you help them solve problems. It might involve producing food, seeds, cooperatives, the school systems. But you really seem to have kind of a blank slate in a way of what are the needs of the area and how can we help them address them.
That's right. I mean, we really want to make sure that whenever we engage with a community, that we're doing it in a participatory way, that the ideas need to come from the local community. And so when I come in with our team, you know, we help to look at what's going well. Where are your resources? Where are your passions? What are you doing well to start with? And how can we multiply the effect of that by coming together? We look for gaps in the situation as well. We offer what technical skills we have, but we always want to build on the passion and the interest of the local community. And that's the privilege of being connected globally, is that I have the ability to, when requested, draw on those passions of the local community and help connect them to resources they might not have known were available so that they could use those to drive that change forward.
What an exciting job. I mean, because it's the opposite, in a way, of what a lot of the government programs are, whether it's, you know, United Nations or anything that any country does, that just decided top down, okay, we're going to ship you so much wheat or something like that. And they're all well-intentioned, and many of them are very, very good. But to do it from ground level rather than saying that you can do it from Rome or from Paris or Geneva or Washington, D.C., and decide what's best for these communities, it has to be not nearly as good as somebody that could be a problem solver working with them, figuring out what they want to have help with and what they're willing to help you get there.
And there are things that we need to approach from both sides. When we're rolling out a vaccination campaign, it's going to work a lot better if it's coordinated. We maintain that cold chain and get those vaccines out to do that in an efficient and with the best practices available. But when we're talking about human development and community development, I do strongly believe that the passion of the local community, they are the change agents.
Well, they are the change agents. And the other thing that strikes me, you're pretty enthusiastic, and it's nice to talk to somebody that feels so charged up by what they're doing. You clearly are.
Yay.
And you're a lucky person. Thinking of lucky people, used to think that you had to be like a billionaire to be that lucky because, you know, like Bill and Melinda Gates, you know, you hear them, they're motivated similarly, and they have lots of money, you know, or Howard Buffett. And it's interesting that people, once they've kind of accomplished everything they could, they like to follow the trail that you're on and be able to make some difference in local levels around the world.
Well, this is what I think is so amazingly powerful about a connectional church. The United Methodist Church has a lot of little tiny congregations all over this country. And maybe one congregation can't fund a whole project, but they're working in their local community. They're developing health ministries and food ministries and reaching out there. And that's what the church in Nepal is doing. So, you know, one local congregation gives $300, another gives $1,000. And because all of these little donations coming in together, I have one church that sends me $25 a month. And with that, we are able to pool together, we're able to multiply, we're able to do some pretty amazing things because we are connected, because we're doing it together.
Well, you know, there are people listening to this podcast that want to be connected, want to be able to do it together. And if they would like more information about the programs that you're involved with or how they could reach out to you, where do they look for information?
Well, I love emails. You can welcome to email me. My email is kparker@umcmission.org. And the United Mission to Nepal also has a website. So you can Google United Mission to Nepal or go directly to umn.org.np.
Well, Catherine, it's amazing what you're doing. I'm a big fan, and I know a lot of people listening are as well. We really are proud of the work that you're doing. Wish you well. I hope some people follow up with you. And I want to thank you for being on Farm to Table Talk.
It's always a joy. Thank you, Roger.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson. If you like what you hear, go to farmtotabletalk.com and follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or go to iTunes to subscribe and give us a review and a rating. Thanks for listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.